Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Brandon Thurston from Wrestlenomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Welcome to another edition of Pollock and Thurston. Brandon never gets tired of that intro. It's a wonderful one, isn't it?
No,
it's the graphics really put that one over the top. I think
I've been meaning to tell you. I think you jump in just before the music is over with, and no one can hear you quite yet.
I'm aware of this, and I've been trying for the last 3 weeks to be getting my timing down, because I think there is some. Because sometimes I've noticed like there's a gap between it ending and when I talk. So this is my internal battle that we will.
Wait till you see yourself back on the screen.
Give me 6 to 8 weeks. We'll have this one down. Also, credit to StreamYard, who you notice on the video clips, it does not default to loop, whereas background music, it is set to default to loop.
Yes. Yes.
So anyway, these are all the things that struggles. People tuned in today to hear all about the machinations behind StreamYard. But how are you doing, Brandon? How are things in Buffalo? Are you due for snow like we are in Toronto on Thursday?
I haven't heard the snow rumors yet.
We're getting 15 centimeters on Thursday, if they are accurate.
Wow, that's a lot of centimeters. That's a few inches at least, I think.
Yes. This is the Canadian-American divide that you get on this show. We have a lot of news that we're going to be getting into. If you want to send in any super chats, you're welcome to do so. But we have a very special guest that's joining us right off the top, as we are going to be continuing our look into the various allegations against Vince McMahon, against John Laurinaitis, against the WWE. And this individual has been at the forefront of a lot of the reporting over at Vice News. Real pleasure to be joined by Tim Marchment, who's with us. And Tim, thanks so much for taking some time to chat with us about it. You have been doing some outstanding work over at Vice, and you were definitely someone Brandon and I wanted to have on the show to talk about.
I really appreciate that, and thanks for having me.
As we go back, it almost feels like it's been ages at this point, but it's only been a couple of weeks since the Janelle Grant lawsuit dropped. And just starting from that beginning point of this this latest investigation into WWE and Vince McMahon, I mean, reading that lawsuit for the first time, Tim, I mean, how different was your reaction to that versus the Wall Street reporting that came out in 2022 versus Vince McMahon, that this one has taken, to me, a lot more of a, it's just had that much more weight that I feel it has carried with people versus in 2022, where you still did see, I think, a lot of Vince McMahon defenders. And this one, it has been a lot more, I would say, cut and dry when you're getting into such gritty details as the lawsuit outlined.
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things. First off, the allegations are so graphic and extreme, and they're very credible. The text messages in the suit, for instance, McMahon and TKO, no one has really disputed those are real, and they significantly buttress the credibility of the story. And aside from those things, the lawsuit goes into so much detail about people who would have been aware there was something inappropriate going on, even if they didn't know every detail. That it makes clear that this appears to have been known and tolerated within WWE, which raises a lot of questions about the company, as well as the fact that there's the specific allegation of trafficking, which is something I cover. And it's a word people throw around a lot, and in a lot of different contexts, it means a lot of different things. But in this context, you're talking about what is alleged to be a commercial sex act using force, fraud, or coercion, like pretty cut and dry. If what she says happened, it meets that definition. And, you know, it's not really a surprise that now we've given that now we've learned there is a serious federal criminal investigation into that, which, you know, is not good news for Vince McMahon.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us, Tim. I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you ended up covering this for Vice. It's something that I've been thinking about, at least, you know, over the last few days or so, is just how much mainstream attention this is getting in some areas versus others. And obviously Vice News is a sort of a general news outlet.
Yeah. So over the last several years, along with my colleague, Anna Merlin, I've been covering the anti-trafficking industry. And in particular, we've done a big series of stories over the last several years on Operation Underground Railroad. That's the anti-trafficking group previously headed by Tim Ballard, who was the big box office hit from last year, Sound of Freedom, was made about. We started looking into that group because we thought some of their stories just didn't add up. They presented this image of like paramilitary heroes jumping into countries in the developing world and personally liberating sex slaves and making all these claims about their work with domestic law enforcement agencies that, you know, just didn't turn out to be true. And at this point, Ballard is now being sued by a number of women and in being investigated in a number of jurisdictions over sex trafficking claims against him. It's a really complicated story, but it has some parallels to the allegations in the WWE case, because you have this charismatic founder who's you know, accused of trafficking women who are reporting to him. So when I saw I'm a longtime wrestling fan. You know,
I could have guessed.
I'm pretty familiar with the general background of, you know, McMahon's alleged behavior over the years. So one of my colleagues, Manisha Krishnan, wrote our initial story on the suit, but having some familiarity with wrestling and with trafficking, it felt like, you know, just hopping in and seeing if there was some stuff to cover. And, you know, it's turned out there's, you know, we've been able to get some new information out, which is good. You know, it's a big, complicated, messy story. And if you can get some new stuff out and add to people's understanding of it, you know, I think that's good. That's our job.
Last week, we had David Bixenspan on the show, and he was mentioning the fact that back in 2017, that the New York Times was attempting to put out an investigative piece into Vince McMahon. But one of the issues that a lot of the women that were speaking with New York Times representatives was the fact that they just didn't quite understand the industry, the ins and outs of it, that someone such as yourself, like, that has to be, you know, this thing that we don't typically look at as a big detail, but hearing something like that, it's a huge thing when it comes to the trust of an industry that really does not have a healthy amount of trust in. It's a very paranoid industry. I'm just curious, as you're reaching out, if you're sensing like there's still kind of that back against the wall mentality when it comes to speaking out, or if it's still, or if people are sort of making an inroads towards voicing their concerns and their own personal experiences with someone that has a better understanding of the industry.
Yeah. So there's a couple of elements to that. One is, in talking to some people, I've definitely found that the fact that I have some familiarity with wrestling is helpful. And I don't think I'm an expert because I read the Wrestling Observer or anything like that. But I think there's a baseline of, you know, if they're trying to explain something complicated and you can make clear that, oh, I kind of, you know, I understand what you're talking about there, that can make someone, you know, that can make someone more comfortable, or they can be speaking about something that if you didn't have some familiarity with it, you wouldn't understand the significance of. So I think it does help, as in any field, if you, you know, if you know the context of where information exists, that can, you know, that can help you. I think from the people I've talked to and people who've chosen not to talk to me in some cases, I think there's still, you know, still a lot of fear of retaliation, and a lot of you know, a lot of concern that, you know, WWE is still largely, you know, it's still run by people who Vince McMahon put in place, even if not at the very top levels, at the levels below that. And my sense is also that there's a lot of concern about fans. Everything from you have, you know, like something like with what happened with Sonya Deville, where she had someone actually break into her house, to, you know, just how toxic social media can be. I think if you're someone on the inside who has knowledge of this, that's a, you know, it's a very, very, very difficult decision to come forward, knowing you're going to have people mad about it and mad at you. And you might be putting yourself, at some risk of harm. I think in this, you know, even broadening it away from just WWE, there's, you know, you see that in lots of industries. You saw that in the Weinstein reporting, when there were lots of, you know, very, very famous, powerful actresses who feared professional retaliation. You know, they feared attacks on their credibility and all sorts of different things, and with good reason. And, you know, it's definitely not as easy for people as, hey, this information is coming out, so now I want to speak out about this. You know, in some cases it might be, people don't want to be defined by something bad that happened to them. Like, that's a totally understandable motive. They don't want to deal with these other things I'm talking about. I have a sense of that people are thinking really seriously about these things. And one reason I pretty strongly suspect that we're not seeing a kind of, flood of tabloid style details is that we're talking about really serious crimes here. If you're someone who was behind an NDA, you know, we know the feds are talking to them and probably telling them, you know, we're not going to put a gag on you, but it would probably be for the best if you kept this confidential for now, not to compromise our investigation. Or if you're someone who hasn't signed an NDA, you may well be talking to a lawyer. Again, same situation. And if you're a witness, you're talking about, you know, possibly being a witness to federal crimes. Those are all cases where, aside from any of the other factors, it's, you know, even if reporters and the public don't like it, it's probably, you know, the best thing to do is not talk, you know, in public right now about it.
You mentioned that if any of the other women who are under NDAs, they may be talking to the feds, and they may not want those stories out right now. I was wondering what you think is behind then Janelle Grant coming out with her lawsuit. Maybe it's just the issue of, you know, allegedly Vince stopped paying, so mm-hmm. she's suing him. So why is that one different, you think?
Yeah, so I mean, I think I don't want to be too speculative here. I want to go by what's in the suit and what we know about, you know, the lawyers involved in the suit. So first off, there is the factor that she had a contractual agreement with McMahon that she says he didn't hold up his end of. So there are real damages there. She's alleging that she's not able to work because of the, you know, the trauma she suffered and the post-traumatic stress disorder that she's currently suffering from. So if she's not, you know, if she didn't get money she was counting on getting, she's seeking damages to have money to live, money that she was counting on and that she's not getting. So, you know, that's a big incentive to sue. But also a lot of the lawsuit is concerned with voiding the NDA, not just on the grounds that the contract wasn't fulfilled, but also that the language in the NDA was too broad and not specific enough to legally hold. Now, when you put that together with the fact that Ann Callis, the lead attorney here, has a background in class action, and that she has spoken about hearing from, you know, other people, my guess is that part of the strategy here is to broaden the suit, whether that means other people bringing lawsuits or other people joining this lawsuit. Those would both, to the best of my knowledge, be avenues that are available to them. And I guess that this is going to get bigger, this suit.
When it comes to Edward Brennan, who's the attorney for John Laurinaitis and covering cases like this, Tim, is this sort of out of the norm for a defendant's attorney to be kind of as public as he has, as we're talking about, you know, a lot of figures in this that are keeping a relatively low profile? Mm-hmm. Edward Brennan seems to be someone that at least is getting his client's message out there in a pretty clear way throughout this reporting that you've been conducting over the last few weeks.
I don't know that it's that unusual. I mean, he's advocating for his client, and he's getting asked questions and he's given answers. I appreciate it, even as I understand why, you know, other lawyers don't even return emails. I don't think there's a right or wrong way to do that. And, you know, he hasn't said a lot about what his strategy is here. I know a lot of people are drawing the inference from that he's seeking to flip on Vince McMahon, or he's looking for a plea deal. I don't know that any of that's true. I take it very much at face value. You know, I and some other reporters have asked him questions, and he's answering them. That's good. And I assume he's doing it because he thinks it serves his client's best interests.
You mentioned earlier the reaction that maybe some women may fear that they would face if they, you know, went public with some of their experiences with WWE. I think one thing that's getting lost in this story to WWE's benefit is that this is more than just a Vince McMahon story, or more than just mm-hmm. about allegations against John Laurinaitis and Vince, but that it's part of what's alleged in the Janelle Grant lawsuit is that there were a number of executives who had knowledge of at least a relationship between Grant and Vince, but didn't mm-hmm. do something to intervene. So, I mean, this lawsuit has been out for almost 3 weeks now, which means the defendants are almost due to have some sort of response. But what have you thought about how WWE has handled it to this point in terms of publicly commenting or not commenting? I'm sure you've reached out.
Yeah. I mean, I've reached out to them for everything I've written that has to do with them, which I think is every story I've written. They have projected a clear belief that this is in the past. These are things that did happen before, before TKO took over, and that Vince McMahon and John Laurinaitis are gone. And that, you know, there are things they don't know about because the people currently in charge weren't there. And there are things they can't really say much about because the people who are accused of them aren't there. I'm not a public relations critic, so I don't really have too much to say about whether that's a good or bad strategy. I will compliment them for being, I think they've been fairly open. They've certainly been responsive, when they're asked questions. I do think that substantively WWE is a defendant here. What's brought up in the lawsuit certainly suggests that it's more than simply a matter of, two executives kind of run amok and doing things secretly in ways that didn't impinge on a broad stratum of upper leadership that would have at least, you know, at face value, taking everything in the lawsuit, at the very least, several top executives would have known that Vince McMahon had an unqualified person who was his girlfriend who he brought in and gave a fake job to. And for that kind of behavior to just be open and tolerated and sort of routine business, it obviously suggests unflattering things about how WWE is run. And there are, it would certainly be reasonable, to ask questions about darker things going on. Were there other executives who were having inappropriate relationships with subordinates? Was knowledge of this limited just to the idea that this was Vince's girlfriend? Things like that. I'm certainly not accusing anybody of anything. I'm saying those are unanswered questions as of this point, that, obviously people want answers to, and hopefully in the process of this litigation, we will get answers to.
So in my understanding, right, you're saying part of the response you're getting from WWE is that there's different leadership in charge now versus when these incidents are alleged to have happened, which I believe is running from 2019 through early 2022. Mm-hmm. I mean, the top two executives in WWE right now are Nick Khan and Paul Levesque, who were there for at least part, if not all, of that time. Nick started in, I believe, August 2020, and Paul's been there for 25 years.
Yeah, certainly. I think it's totally fair for them to say, hey, Vince McMahon isn't here anymore, and you know, the ultimate top people at
TKO wasn't
at
there.
TKO weren't here at the same time. It's like, come on. Especially because obviously so there's two things. One central part of this is the whole process of WWE becoming part of TKO, and we know that at the least they knew it was in the Wall Street Journal. And we know that, you know, some of these executives knew more than that. We don't know how much they knew of what was in the suit, but we know they knew more than they were reading in the paper. They knew enough to list McMahon as a risk in SEC filings and all that.
And I'm sure they did diligence when they were exploring the notion of a merger. And I'm pretty sure that's even stated in some of the filings that they put out there.
Information
about the merger deal.
I think a lot of the bigger questions here have to do with that. And it's a question I've definitely put to them. It's like, you know, you put together this $21 billion deal, knowing all these NDAs were out there, knowing that you were kind of buying a box of radioactive material. Now the radioactive material has gone off. Like, what kind of investigation did you do prior to that? What kind of due diligence did you do before that? I haven't gotten a good answer to that, but it remains a question I have, and that I imagine probably some shareholders have, is we know there was this big investigation in the NDAs. What kind of broader investigation was there into McMahon's behavior? Because, you know, if you have somebody who has all these NDAs for inappropriate behavior with women, you can presume there may be women who want to bring forth those allegations and haven't signed NDAs. You know, was there an investigation into his broader pattern of behavior going back all this time? So that's kind of one set of questions. And then there's another set of questions that I class with those, because they both have to do with potential liabilities here and what kind of diligence was done into them, which is that, so we reported on the previously unpublished portion of the Ashley Massaro affidavit. And basically the significance of this is that in preparing a sworn affidavit as part of a concussion lawsuit in 2017, Ashley Massaro, who was a WWE wrestler, had material which was not ultimately part of the affidavit, but was something she was prepared to submit to the court as a sworn affidavit, under penalty of perjury, saying that there was a casting couch scheme that she had been retaliated against for refusing McMahon's sexual advances, and specifically that she had seen him making out with female wrestlers in the locker room. So those are allegations, but they are serious ones, and they're ones, you know, that she was prepared to swear to. So that opens to me this whole other box that is kind of adjacent to, but distinct from, the Grant lawsuit, which is this true that, you know, Vince McMahon was sexually preying on, on wrestlers, on people who worked for WWE? And if so, you know, what kind of potential liability does that open? How much has that been investigated internally? Those are questions I don't have good answers to. I've been asking them, and I'm sure a lot of other people have as well, because there's a lot of potential plaintiffs there.
And as you uncovered, an NCIS investigation that was launched right after Massaro's death in 2019 that wrapped up 4 years ago, that we are just now learning of and not knowing what the findings were as well. Like, that certainly is of great interest, I would say, to sort of what was this 6-month investigation and what was found. And if not for this story resurfacing, would anyone have even heard about this investigation?
Yeah. And there are a couple of interesting things about that. So one is when I found out about that investigation, NCIS said that they could only release more information under FOIA. That has a 20-day response time on that. I did file, and I'm sure many other journalists have as well, asking for any files and associated documents, like how it came across their desk, that sort of thing. So that has a 20-day turnaround time. So we should be getting, hopefully we'll be getting something on that in a couple of weeks. I asked for expedited processing because it's a subject of intense public interest. If we're lucky, in a couple of weeks, they'll release all the documents they have on that. Or they could, in a couple of weeks, just say, hey, we're still looking into it, and it can be years until anything about that comes out. But even from what we know, there is something interesting, which is that in WWE's initial denials that management had been aware of this, which are contradicted by John Laurinaitis, and his contradictions are corroborated by other evidence, they said that if they'd been aware of this, they would have referred it to the base commander. The incident happened in 2006. The only investigation we're aware of started the month after Massaro died. So this is just an inference, but I think it's fair to infer that military investigators became aware of the affidavit, possibly due to publicity, and then they decided to look into it. So it was a 6-month investigation. It's possible that it might confirm her story. It's possible it might refute her story. It's possible they might say too much time had passed and we couldn't really investigate it. We don't know. But we do know that it started 13 years after the alleged incident, that WWE management was aware, and that despite what they said, it doesn't appear they reported the investigation. So, you know, there's probably not any legal consequences attaching to that or anything, but it would be very good to know who those people were who precisely were aware of it and would have been responsible for reporting it, because I don't think it's great to say that if we had been aware of this alleged rape, we would have reported it, and for it to turn out that you were aware of it and that you didn't report it, if that makes sense.
And just so people are aware, the NCIS is not a it's not a crime drama, but the naval investigation.
Yeah, and so the reason they're looking into it specifically is that Massaro alleged that she became dehydrated and she was taken to a medical clinic at a military facility, and that there someone who represented himself as an army doctor assaulted her. So I know in the past there had been reporters who had they had filed FOIAs with the army, but in my digging around, it became clear that she had been taken to a clinic that was staffed specifically by Navy personnel. So the jurisdiction for that follows to NCIS, and God knows who, we may get some kind of terrible procedural drama about that. I don't even know if that show is still in the air. Maybe it went off 20 years ago, but. You know, yeah, they looked into it.
I'm going back to the comment you made about a lot of the women and one of their concerns being fans out there as well. And I think that is an aspect to all of this, that if you are someone that has undergone, harassment of any degree, and you're just looking at, so much of this came out 2 years ago, and here this individual in Vince McMahon is met with a hero's embrace walking out on television days mm-hmm. later. And there was it's like, we look at this Janelle Grant lawsuit and how much is on the victim to just disclose the most horrific of details, attaching a name, attaching a face, making this a real person that this all happened to. And it just seems there's such a burden on these victims to have to like leave the skeptic there with no other alternative but to give them credence to these allegations. I completely understand why these women out there would be like, who would want to take this on beyond just having a belief that they're doing the right thing? Like, there's just so much that I don't think I could like accurately sway someone in that decision if they were on the fence about it.
Yeah, it's tough, especially because, the question is kind of what's the ultimate benefit of that? If it's to prove that Vince McMahon is a bad person, the allegations are out there and people are going to believe them or not. Like, you're not really, like, he has been accused of behavior that's so extreme. There's really not too much more, I don't think, you could do to further blacken his reputation. There are many motivations someone might have for coming forward or not coming forward, and all of them are good and acceptable. It's not on, you know, survivors of sexual misconduct or violence to do anything in particular other than what, you know, is best for them and their families, and everyone has a different situation. But I do think that there probably is value in some of the stories that people have to tell that wouldn't just be corroborative of the sort of thing we're talking about already, because the part that's opaque to us is really about who knew what, are those people still there, and how did and does WWE work as a system? And that's where I really hope people with knowledge of that can and do come forward through whatever means, talking to reporters, engaging, you know, or engaging the legal system, or really whatever. Just because I do think those things are inherently important to know about. And I also think that most institutions, when they suffer a kind of reputational hit of the scope of the one WWE has, their instincts are going to be to kind of do damage control and then to put it in the past. And that's understandable. That's not saying anybody in charge of WWE is doing bad if that's what they're thinking. If they're thinking, we just want to move forward, we don't want to dwell on all this stuff from the past. They have a big business to run. They have a lot of people they're responsible for. And there are doubtless a lot of people in charge who have nothing to do with any of this stuff and, you know, are concerned about it from that angle. But I really think if you don't examine some of that stuff and bring it out into light, you can't correct against it happening again, especially when multiple generations of the people who run wrestling, you know, came up under McMahon. And even if you're not talking about the kind of extreme behavior alleged in the Grant suit, there are still systems in place around, like, you know, who gets hired and who gets put into a more advantageous position and all the rest of it that probably really, really need to be examined and overhauled, just to make sure that people who are working for this big company without real labor protections have, you know, fair chances to advance in their careers, anything else aside.
And we now have, I would say, two cases of people having their careers negatively impacted because of, you know, rejecting sexual advances allegedly by Vince McMahon. In terms of Ashley Massaro, we have the $7.5 million NDA that the talent who agreed to that NDA, alleging that she was coerced into oral sex, and then when she rejected further advances, she was eventually demoted and then released. So I think there's at least two cases there, and it might be, you know, leaving something out that's related to that too, that of, you know, Vince McMahon allegedly preying on women, and when it didn't work out the way he wanted to, he basically punished them.
Yeah. That's serious. And to me, the fact that you have two credible allegations of that suggests there's probably more. And if you've got all those, you've got, you know, it starts to look like a system. It looks like a casting couch. That's the term I've used to describe this to people. And you know, that's really disturbing, and there's no place for that.
Just as we wind things down here, Tim, when we look at the business implications for WWE, I mean, when we're looking at kind of their barometer of good news, bad news, it centers around their stock that has largely been unaffected by all of this news. It comes 2 days after the announcement of their big deal with Netflix, and the only comment we have got from Netflix is through Bella Bajaria, who was very dismissive of, well, I won't say dismissive, but I mean, pretty much just left it that Vince is gone, and this, you know, leaving people with the conclusion it was a Vince McMahon problem and Vince McMahon is gone. It doesn't seem to be as though there is any of those pressure points that TKO has faced in the wake of this scandal. And it's just power through this. And we have not seen any impact of any consequence to their core business.
No, we haven't. And, you know, y'all know more about WWE business than I do. But as I understand, it's at this point it should be in terms of the stock price, a pretty cruise control business. They've got these big deals locked in for the foreseeable future. And while they're at a business peak right now in terms of audience and revenue and attendance and all these things, you know, if they lose 2/3 of their fan base because people are grossed out and, you know, they start having to book smaller buildings and so on, they're still going to be making money. Just hand over.
That's definitely not happening yet.
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of, you know, the stock price is just a reflection of what investors think its future business is going to be like. And there's every reason to think the future business is going to be good. On the other hand, the sort of lawsuit they're now engaged in, and the potential for, you know, there to be more parties to the lawsuit or more similar lawsuits brought, even apart from the criminal investigation, is the kind that drips on over a really long time. And one of the questions I would really like to have an answer to, which I don't, you know, expect anyone's going to get unless an insider decides to leak some proprietary business information they really shouldn't, is what kind of out clauses that people like Netflix has. Because, you know, if you have a protracted suit where every day the, you know, depraved inner workings of WWE are exposed, you know, in court over a period of months, and, you know, it's incurring extreme reputational damage or something, do they even have out clauses in those contracts? And what would trigger them? Those are the sorts of questions I'm really curious about, because I, you know, this isn't something I know, but I think is a matter of common sense, is that if this lawsuit had been filed a week earlier than it was, you know, would Netflix have signed it, or would they have signed it in this form? Like, obviously that's probably not, or they, you know, they probably would have rethought it. You know, that's all that's to say, from what I know, I don't see how this would like seriously affect their core business, unless it did. And that's, I guess it's a little bit of a lame way to put it, but, I really wouldn't write off that possibility. You know, if things become so exposed, if cover-ups become exposed, or if the knowledge of certain executives is of a sort that would really kind of undermine the image of the company even more than it already has been, are there partners of theirs who could look for outs? And also, what are the potential ramifications there for sponsors, which is obviously really big to WWE? And, you know, one of the talking points from Endeavor, as I understand it, like the logic of putting this deal together was that they were able to increase sponsorship for the UFC. I actually saw in one of the Hollywood trade pubs, they gave them credit for bringing in Bud Light as a sponsor for UFC, which I scratched my head at because I'm so old. I remember Brock Lesnar talking about how he hated Bud Light.
Yes.
He loves Coors Light like 10 years ago.
And then had to apologize right after.
Yeah, but the logic of it is definitely, hey, we're Endeavor, we're big Hollywood types, we can up the prestige of WWE, we can get more blue chip sponsorship in, yada yada yada. If sponsors leave, or if all that just falls apart, how does that affect the kind of underlying logic of TKO?
And I think
that I think is a super open question.
I think Slim Jim backing out, at least for a day, that did seem to apply some pressure that resulted in Vince McMahon resigning.
Yeah, you know, if your idea is that, hey, if we bring this together with the UFC and we have these master deal makers in charge, we're going to get Tesla to be putting its logo on the mats at WrestleMania, and all of a sudden you're struggling to get Slim Jim to stop from fleeing in the face of a sex trafficking investigation, it's not good. So I don't think this looks to me to pose any sort of like existential risk to the company or anything, but I think it's way too easy to just say, oh, they're past it, and, you know, they're just going to move on. This is not the sort of thing anybody wants their brand associated with. And so even if you don't see people leaving, that's probably going to be one of the interesting stories going forward as well, is like what kind of companies that otherwise would have been open to being associated with WWE just don't have any interest now.
Yeah, they just made a deal with X to do WWE Speed on that platform.
X, a great brand safe platform that every reputable company in America is running towards in droves. Right,
I bet Linda Iaccarino has some experience selling advertising with WWE since she was at NBC Universal before. But I, you know, in getting ready to talk with you today, I read the interview you did on indignity.substack.com, talking about, in part, which I really recommend people read, talking in part about the media coverage that this story has gotten. And I would like to focus on that a bit. And just, it seems like a lot of this coverage, it's helpful that Vince McMahon is friends with Donald Trump in terms of getting this story media coverage, because it's sort of, it gets to be, and I think maybe it almost undermines, it gets to be sort of an addendum to all these broader, more, you know, consumable, culture stories around whether it's, you know, Donald Trump or Weinstein or Bill Cosby or Jeffrey Epstein. And there's, in my view, there's a lot of reticence to cover wrestling seriously in cases like this that really warrant it, where sports media, it's a little too fake for sports media, even though they do seem, especially in the Nikon era, really cover the business story strongly, positive stories. But, you know, we've seen ESPN's coverage of this story has been pretty minimal. But there has been Wall Street Journal, there has been Vice News. But I think you put it the most embarrassing corner of sports and entertainment, which is pro wrestling. Nobody really wants to get in there when it comes to a serious story about pro wrestling sometimes, even when we're talking about, you know, allegedly sexual assault and sex trafficking.
Yeah, it's I think it's a real shame, and I think outlets should cover this seriously. Now, obviously there's a lot in the world to cover and you can't cover everything, and I understand that. You know, in the grand scheme of things, WWE isn't all that big a company. And if you're not looking at this because you're looking at you know, some giant company poisoning towns drinking water, I totally get it. But yeah, well, you know, when you look at a big institution like ESPN that certainly has time to do softer coverage of, you know, whether Cody Rhodes wants to finish the story or, you know, what kind of punishment Rhea Ripley's going to deal out to her next opponent, I do think there should be some resources devoted to covering this. It's you know, the question of whether the outcomes are predetermined or not is pretty irrelevant. It's a sport in every sense it really matters, and so, you know, places that cover it as, you know, a sport or a pseudo sport, this is the biggest story going on in it. And so I do think it deserves to be covered. And for places that wouldn't necessarily cover it, you know, it's a very straightforward proposition that this is a big, powerful company with an exceptionally vulnerable and many would argue exploited labor force that's, you know, in a position where there are questions about casting couches and sex trafficking and all these different things. And it is also connected up to some of the most powerful cultural institutions in the country. You know, like the connection with Donald Trump is not just a matter of him having been at WrestleMania or whatever. Linda McMahon runs a Trump-aligned super PAC. She's a former cabinet official. All the things in the lawsuit had their origination in what was previously it was called the Trump Park Stanford, a Trump developed, a luxury condo where the McMahons bought one of the first penthouses. There were, you know, some of the first people in there. And, you know, Trump has his own ties to different, people who've been convicted or accused of trafficking. And so political reporters might want to look at all that. But when you look at those kind of ties, or, you know, the fact that there are serious questions about, like, how much of this Ari Emanuel knew before he decided to plunge ahead in the deal, you're really talking about some of the most powerful people in America and Vince McMahon's direct connections to them. And that's not to hold them accountable for his alleged behavior, but it is to say that whatever someone makes of wrestling, and I think on its own terms, it deserves serious coverage. you know, this isn't an abstract thing. This is how the friends, business associates, business partners of some of the most powerful people in the country are treating the people who work for them. And, you know, if you're okay with that, you're okay with that. If you're not okay with that, you're not okay with it. But the biggest thing that sits with me is just there's a lot we don't know about that. And I, you know, I hope we get answers. I'm going to be looking for answers. I know other reporters will be. And I really hope we get them, because this, you know, this just isn't the sort of thing that should be tolerated in powerful circles, or, you know, any circles, but especially not, you know, the ones the masters of the universe move in. They have control over people's lives. They have control over people's futures. And, you know, this is how one of their close associates is apparently behaving.
Well, Tim, you have been very generous with your time. And this is where I would usually ask what you're working on. I would imagine you probably can't disclose what you are working on, but I know that everyone that's following this show will be following your coverage along with your colleagues over at Vice. And we just want to thank you very much for taking this extended time to chat with us, and you know, tremendous reporting on your behalf. This is all very important stuff. And you're somebody that I think a lot of people are leaning on a real, like, elevated platform that can be drawing a lot of attention to what's a very, very important story.
I really appreciate that. And I don't know if I'll ever do another story on this. You know, if I don't find anything out, then there will not be anything to share. But I'm certainly going to be asking the kind of questions we've discussed here. I know other reporters, and really importantly, other, you know, lawyers will be. And so I guess the one thing I would say is, if people are feeling frustrated that it seems like nothing is happening, these things play out. They can play out on a really long time span. Just let me take 1 second to just give an example of that. I was mentioning that my colleague Anna Merlin and I covered Operation Underground Railroad for a long time. We got information last, I think, June, corroborated information that Tim Ballard had left Operation Underground Railroad amidst multiple claims to the board of sexual misconduct. And we weren't able to report that until September, just because it took a long time to, you know, nail it down and kind of nail down what had happened and what we were actually talking about. I understand that with something this kind of seismic, people want to know everything. I really do think the information people want to know is going to come out. And I really do believe that there will be accountability for people who, you know, were aware of it or complicit in it or whatever you want to say. But it just takes a while. You're talking about serious criminal accusations and a legal process that rightly gives the accused, you know, in both civil and criminal cases, a lot of ways to defend themselves. It's a slow process. It should be a slow process. This isn't something where anybody's just going to take a broom and start pointing at people in WWE headquarters and say, kind of, you must have known about this, hit the bricks. It doesn't work like that. And it shouldn't work like that. If we want serious justice here, we're just going to have to be patient. I don't think there's any danger of it being forgotten about, or the process not going forward. Even as earlier, I was talking about my fears that maybe people will be able to just put it in the past. There's too much of it.
Do you want to give out any information in case there's anybody out there that maybe does want to reach out to you confidentially? Is there a direction you would like to give out?
Yeah, absolutely. Give me 1 second just to pull up my own signal number, because I don't know it offhand. But you can always email me at tim.marchman@vice.com. Or signal me at 267-713-9832. And just to be clear, you know, if you want to reach out, I am not going to ask you what are the horrible things you saw or experienced or anything like that. I don't even need to know who you are right off the bat. I think sometimes people have they don't know how that process works. I'm happy to start a conversation by just talking about, like, you know, generally what position you're in, how our process works, how we verify information, how we protect sources, what are good ways for you to prevent an employer or another party from finding out you're talking to a reporter, things like that. can really start from wherever, you know, wherever people want to start from. And I can also be direct messaged on Twitter. I have open DMs. It's at Tim Marchman. So yeah, if you're somebody who's thinking about talking, or, you know, you're a wrestling fan who remembers an old interview that you think might be relevant, or you just have questions you want to ask about the FOIA process or whatever, reach out to me by any of those means, and I'm always happy to talk.
And we'll include that in the show description as well, with that information if anybody wants it. But again, thank you so much, Tim. We appreciate all of your time coming on and chatting with us. It's been great to discuss with you what's obviously a very very trying story for a lot of people out there, but super important one, of course.
Yeah, appreciate your work as well. Thanks for having me, and you know, maybe I'll have me back sometime, and we can talk about like AEW booking or something less depressing.
Will Cody finish the story?
We'll get to the
investigative story. All right. Thanks a lot, Tim. All the best.
Thank you, Tim.
Take care.
All right. Tim Marchman joining us from Vice News.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
And I mean, there has been, you know, in the last week, I would say, Brandon, there has been, you know, some reaction that we have seen from various individuals around Vince McMahon. Bruce Pritchard did semi address this on his podcast. I mean, basically addressing it by stating he can't address it.
Yes, he did. For legal reasons.
For legal reasons. He said that I'm not at liberty to discuss any legal matters with the company whatsoever. And there can't be a response from a legal standpoint. As you can ask till you're blue in the face, that's going to be your answer. I'm not involved. I'm not being sued. I'm not accused of anything. And it's a legal matter. So that is it. He said that if you work at a large company and your large company is being sued, then there's very little that you can say about it. And if you do, that's a good way for you to lose your job.
Yes. So this is why he can't answer. You know, did Vince, you know, text you or call you to give you suggestions about creative between July 2022 and January 2023? Is he texting you now and calling you now about creative and giving you suggestions about what you should do with creative, even though he's resigned from the company? That's for legal reasons. He can't answer that.
No, until he's blue in the face, which is quite the ability for someone to both be able to be blue in the face and red in the face. Yes. Bruce Pritchard has been able to do throughout his career. So beyond that, I mean, I would say the most significant name out there in terms of somebody, you know, within wrestling, I would say Bret Hart came out pretty strong in terms of his condemnation of Vince McMahon, and even apologizing, like he disclosed recently to Rita Chatterton, who he had been not just dismissive, but just like some pretty appalling, you know, depictions of Rita Chatterton in an old interview, and just stating that he just never believed that Vince McMahon could have done something like that. And he gave Vince McMahon, he stated it, like reading those text messages, that was Vince McMahon, that he was reading those texts and doesn't have any doubt in terms of this, and certainly believes Rita Chatterton now, and saw this as the last vestige of a, you know, defense that he ever had of Vince McMahon. But that it carries a lot of weight when you have someone the level of a Bret Hart that is stating this, as opposed to, you know, someone that, that doesn't have that kind of long-term history with Vince McMahon.
Yeah. I mean, clearly the details that are disclosed in the Grant complaint, have changed the way people feel about this. There were four NDAs that we knew of from four different women. There were a couple allegations on top of that that were known, for years, really. And that didn't stop people from thanking Vince McMahon for all of the great entertainment that he provided them. But having these details in the level that we do has changed some people's sentiments. Just to add to the Bruce Pritchard notion that he can't talk about it for legal reasons, that hasn't stopped Paul Levesque from at least fielding questions about it. That hasn't stopped Cody Rhodes, a talent, not even an executive, from talking about and taking questions about it. Seth Rollins has talked about it a couple times now. There are plenty of questions that can be asked. Now, whether or not people want to answer them is another story. They're at liberty to say or not say what they want. But the notion that you can't talk about anything that would be pertinent to this story for legal reasons, I don't buy.
No, there's plenty that he could state that is not defamatory, that's not impeding an investigation. But I mean, he is not incentivized to disclose any of that. And I think that's the situation that he's going to be in, that he's not going to put himself out there. In terms of Tony Khan, he was asked a bit about this in an interview with FanSided, and Tony Khan's comment was, quote, "I can't comment on the terrible allegations against WWE right now. For us, first and foremost, trying to create a safe locker room environment for everybody, women and men. We have a really, really good bond. I think we have a great locker room, and everyone knows there's a support system there. There's many channels. There's people you can talk to," end quote. So sort of yes. Just a general comment on the AEW locker room in contrast.
Yeah. And one thing that I think is important to emphasize when we talk about this story too, is yes, this is not just a Vince McMahon story or John Laurinaitis story. It's a WWE story, but it's also, this goes beyond WWE clearly. I mean, there's been stories for years, and we can just think about the speaking out movement and how many stories that disclosed across mainly independent companies. But clearly there are systemic issues and questions that need to be raised towards not just WWE, but all the other companies, including AEW as well. And, you know, we've heard things that that can't be reported because you need victims to be on board with disclosing those things. But you know, there are a wide range of sexual misconduct problems, historically in this business across virtually all wrestling companies. And, you know, Tony Khan took a lot of questions, took three questions to be exact, after World's End, after that pay-per-view, about, you know, rumors that were surrounding Chris Jericho at that time. And, I think we said at that time, you know, we weren't really satisfied with those answers. You know, I would want to know, I mean, for one thing, one thing he said in the course of responding to those questions was that he has the safest, safest workplace, right? After you read the Janelle Grant lawsuit, that sets a pretty low bar. And he was pretty nonspecific about what talent would really do. I mean, I would want to ask him if somebody came to you today and said, you know, look, I'm dealing with, this sexual harassment problem with so-and-so, you know, what advice would you give them? And he has pointed a lot to the discipline committee. And I would want to know, you know, who are the members of the discipline committee? And does it include anyone who's not working full time for AEW, who you can truly say is independent and doesn't have any professional or personal relationships with anybody who you
who supervise? Are they? What are their experiences in this kind of a field? What is their background of dealing with allegations of sexual assault, of dealing with just the process of going through that? I think that these are the kinds of things that I think this demands extreme scrutiny. The benefit of the doubt should be out the window, I think, across the board. Like, whether that's fair or unfair to whatever promotion you want to look at, I think you have to be looking at this with greater scrutiny in terms of, like, just take our word for it, only carries so much weight. And I think specifics are needed. And we are so locked into this industry that has no union, no association, and therefore protections for these performers are they're out the window. Your leverage is in direct relation to your value to a company, but as a body of talent, these are not talent that are all unified, that do not have a third party outlet to go to if they have issues, that can sit down at a bargaining table, that can be cut into various, you know, revenue streams. And when we're talking about just the basic core tenets of health and a safe work environment, like, these are all things that I think there can be improvements upon, and at least more of a spotlight onto what are the practices in place. And this is an absolute extreme case in Janelle Grant, but that does not mean or diminishes other people's experiences in some of these workplaces that would not fly anywhere else. And I think, like, this, anyone that is running a company, I think, should be looking at this as, what can we do better? And transparency is something completely lacking in this industry, in these fields.
A lot of it in WWE, what we know about WWE is partially because it is, or was, and is now part of a publicly traded company. And there's a certain amount of transparency that the SEC requires because of that. And that's, you know, the financial issue around these NDAs being basically non-recorded company expenses is, I would have to think through it again, you know, maybe the only reason that we know any of this in the first place. If I could go back to Bruce Pritchard again for one second, it's not as relevant that he talks about this. He is what the executive producer, I don't know what his title is. He's not among the leading executives in WWE. We have heard questions asked to Paul Levesque, a few of them. We've heard nothing from the number one executive, who is Nick Khan, about this. There's been no official statement from WWE. There's been a statement by TKO, but not from WWE itself.
Nothing in Las Vegas last week in conjunction with the press event that they held as well, because that was the point you brought up. I mean, this is not just a big event for WWE. It's his hometown, and you would think that, you know, they are strategic when they put Nick Khan out there, and that would have, to me, made sense that would have been, if all things were equal, a time that you would have Nick Khan out there doing the rounds and, you know, speaking.
Yeah. And so I don't want to make it sound like we're saying Bruce Pritchard needs to speak about this, but it would be nice to hear from Nick Khan, who is, and before Bruce Pritchard and anybody further down the rankings here, the lead executive needs to be asked questions about this.
We also have, I mean, last week we dedicated the whole, well, most of the show to the Titangate scandal from the early 90s. And Lee Cole, who's the older brother of Tom Cole, who was one of the ring boy in question that was, I think, most closely associated with the scandals in the early 90s, took his life several years ago. And Lee Cole, he's been running his channel online and going through a lot of these, a lot of the scandal of the early 90s and what was alleged and his own evidence that he has gathered over the years. And he is promoting that he will be doing an interview with an unnamed ring boy who worked for the WWF from 1986 until 1988 and has never spoken publicly before. There's just like a teaser video up on their YouTube channel. Again, they have not stated who this is, just that they have never spoke publicly before and have not mentioned when this interview will be released. But that is pretty significant, Brandon, that we brought up last week, the idea of, does this embolden anyone to come forward? And like, I would not be that dismissive of the idea of like a larger federal investigation that is looking at any history of accusations of trafficking and child abuse that went on in this company, as was alleged, and involved the, you know, the individuals that we talked about, all the key players last week. But I think that's pretty significant if people pay attention to this and a victim coming forward.
Right. Yeah, but we talked to Bix last week, you know, and according to the research that he's done, they've originally, when Vince ended up being indicted for the steroid trial, they were originally looking into the Ring Boy scandal, what we call the Ring Boy scandal. Mm-hmm. And those events are alleged to have happened late 80s at the earliest, or about, God, with that one, who knows? But in particular, the Ring Boy scandal, a lot of the events and a lot of the people who come forward, things happened to them in the late 80s, I believe 87 in particular with this person that Tom Cole is going to talk to.
Yeah, he worked there from 86 to 88 is what's listed here.
So, I mean, I don't know. We're not lawyers. I don't know what the statute of limitations would be, if there is any in this case. But the reports that we have, I believe, from the Wall Street Journal and NBC and ABC have all confirmed that, yes, there's a federal investigation into misconduct, sex trafficking related to Vince McMahon, and it is in New York. I've emailed the attorney general a couple times, have not heard back. Those events, at least some of them, are alleged to have occurred in New York. The Rita Chatterton alleged rape occurred in New York. So there's reasons why that those elements might add up.
So we will continue to follow these. Is there anything over the last week just in regards to the investigations that have jumped out at you? I mean, you mentioned in the interview, but this Friday will mark 3 weeks, or Thursday, yes, would be the 3 week mark since the lawsuit was filed. So what does that mean for the defendants?
I believe it means by Friday we have to hear some sort of response, or it could just get extended. They could, you know, ask the judge to extend them out to beyond this Friday. But I believe that means we will hear a response. I don't know if it'll be one. It's probably going to be a motion to dismiss, I would think. I don't know if it'll be just one lawyer representing all three parties here, because we clearly have got John Laurinaitis and Vince McMahon on different pages.
I don't know if Edward Brennan is representing WWE and Vince McMahon, but we'll find out.
Yeah. But it'll be interesting to see. And I, you know, I've really questioned whether WWE and Vince McMahon will remain on the same page here. People have raised the issue about, you know, whether or not this will end up being settled. And of course, most legal cases end up being settled. And I know people have pointed to comments from Ann Callis and sort of drawing a conclusion from that, saying it doesn't sound like they want to settle because they want to bring in other people. And, you know, we just talked to Tim and he made it sound like he does get the sense that they want to bring in other people to be a part of this case. I have no strong sense of whether or not this will be settled or how, you know, open or not open Janelle Grant is to settling this. I don't know. I mean, you could definitely see Vince, the characteristics that we know about Vince McMahon and the fact that he has, you know, no full-time job anymore. He might be really opposed to settling, but who knows? I would expect them to move to dismiss, and at least Vince's side to try to keep this in arbitration. My layman view is that it's going to be an uphill battle because of various factors, including the Speak Out Act. It seems as if anything is if the Speak Out Act is supposed to protect any sort of situation, it seems that it applies in this case because this is an NDA related to sexual assault. The overly broad language, the plaintiffs argue, and what else? There's other factors as well, including, she argues that she was, you know, coerced to sign this NDA and she did so under duress. And there's something else I'm even leaving out. I think it will be an uphill battle for this to be dismissed and go into arbitration.
Let's move on over to TNA, because there's some more news that has come out in the wake of Scott D'Amore's firing at the company. Fightful Select had a new report that came out on Tuesday, and the outlet stated that it has learned that the news was a shock to many, including the roster, but the wheels were in motion for D'Amore's termination a month prior. D'Amore adamantly did not want to leave TNA, though Anthem had stated they wished to present it as a mutual departure. D'Amore was insistent that the two sides did not refer to it as his decision to leave or a mutual departure. There were talent who claimed that it was relayed to them that D'Amore stepped down, but that was not the case. Beyond that, Ontario, where Anthem is based, has strict employment laws for employers, and not agreeing that the departure was mutual was in the best interest of D'Amore moving forward. There was correspondence between the two sides to aid in the transition to new president Anthony Ciccioni into the role. We're told that D'Amore has spoken highly of Ciccioni, but was reiterated that he didn't want to leave the role. A couple of weeks after his termination became evident, D'Amore made efforts to buy TNA, which were outright rejected. And the rest of that report can be read at FightfulSelect.com, but does sort of give you an indication here of when the offer came from D'Amore to seem to be like a last-ditch effort was to make the attempt to buy TNA, which it seems Anthem was not interested at all. Also added to this is a report from Nick Houseman at House of Wrestling that Ed Nordholm, who was at one point the president of Anthem Wrestling Exhibitions, and I don't know how many different changes that title has gone. They go through a lot of titles. But essentially, it was Ed Nordholm overseeing Scott D'Amore and Don Callis back in 2017. And Ed Nordholm had been an existing executive at Anthem, is still an executive at Anthem, but is now, according to this report, no longer working with TNA, that will be Anthony Ciccione's domain moving forward. But this is a lot of movement on the executive level, and this site is probably getting a lot of updates with
Scott D'Amore is still on it. Scott D'Amore is still listed.
Scott D'Amore is still on
Entertainment.
Oh, okay, yes. Well, they haven't updated that yet. So,
Do you know anything as a resident of Ontario? Do you know anything about what might be being referred to here about labor laws in Ontario?
I would have to speak with a lawyer about the specific advantage. I'm sure like there's certainly credence to like the difference of this being like a mutual decision to depart as opposed to Scott D'Amore being fired, which is what he is. And just what that means for him moving forward as well. I mean, Scott D'Amore has not stated anything publicly, but I think you can look at this as, you know, somebody that obviously wanted to stay with the company. He was not looking to leave, and the attempt to buy TNA just seemed to be sort of, you know, his last ditch effort of doing something with it. And I mean, we're going to see what, because TNA is in a position where it's not all that unlike Ring of Honor a few years ago when Cody's deal was up and the Young Bucks deal was up and you saw Ring of Honor. It's like, are you going to put money into this? Are you going to be competing with AEW, or are you just going to be a content creator that fulfills the Sinclair syndication programming? And with TNA, are you out there and actively going to be going for significant free agents? Like we know years ago they made an offer to Chris Jericho. We know that they went out and they signed Trinity and at least had her for almost a year. We knew that they had interest in CM Punk. Okada just came onto the market. Are they going to be in the market for those talents, or are they just going to have, you know, we're producing content and we're doing it under a certain budget and we're not going above and beyond what it will take to be, I will say, competing with the level of AEW for free agents. I think WWE is a different stratosphere financially.
So we take this at face value that a lot of the issues that led to Scott D'Amore being terminated from Impact, Anthem, TNA, is that it's budgeting issues. So, I mean, I would have to conclude from that TNA is not profitable and that they're losing money on this. It is creating content for Anthem, which owns Access TV. So I think there might even be like a matter of accounting philosophy. You're not paying any rights fee, I would think, for this, because you're just putting it on your TV and you're benefiting from the content, which you would otherwise have to pay something to get, you know, something on Access TV from 8 to 10, on Thursdays. But I would think that this is not, in their view, you know, profitable enough anyway. So, I mean, is there that much of an opportunity for a company at the level of TNA to gain a larger audience and generate more revenue? I would say that the opportunity is incremental at best.
I would certainly argue that, you know, TNA is in, they're at a level and it's hard to see them getting out to whatever that next level would be. But if you're looking for any encouraging signs, certainly like this last month was the first time you did see, you know, they drew, I think it was like 1200 and 1600 on back-to-back nights in Vegas. They're going back to Vegas in April as well for their pay-per-view. So they're going back pretty quickly. And from the Observer reporting, like did one of their best numbers in years on pay-per-view as well. So, I mean, we're talking about a great TNA number that would be a fraction of an AEW pay-per-view, but regardless, like for them, you were at least.
And this decision comes after that, you know, increase in consumer sales here.
Yes. So, I mean, the next month or two will be interesting to see, because I mean, the online response, it seems to be very much on the side of why did Anthem do this, and looking at it as, and I mean, the wrestlers have been almost as vocal. Like you have had a lot of talent that are how many of these talents were hired directly by Scott D'Amore. Of course, there's going to be that loyalty to many that, you know, maybe they came to TNA because of the creative direction, the environment there, and how many are going to have that same loyalty to a company that got rid of this person that was the leader for TNA.
Yes.
So there you have it on the latest on the TNA front. I always say, like, TNA, the business model, it was a behind the scenes documentary on a week to week basis. I mean, that going back to 2002, that's the programming of TNA. Could you imagine just following like the behind the scenes of this?
Isn't
company
that, that Jerry Jarrett's book? I think it would be a good basis for
the best of times. Yes.
Yes,
it was. All right. Some other news to talk about before we wrap things up here. Rocky Romero is now a member of the AEW front office. Oh, man. So New Japan's lost someone else? Nope. He's still working with New Japan, however that works. So Rocky Romero, who is like become this guy has become like a higher level of Jimmy Hart that just works with everyone and continues to do so. So he's got
CMLL
commitments. Headliner for CMLL, AEW front office. Who knows what else? But now
he helped navigate the Carl Anderson and Luke Gallows while they were under contract with WWE, working with New Japan.
That's right. So I would be curious what his role is in the AEW front office. I like all we know is front office position. I don't know what that entails. So that remains to be seen. Ratings notes. Did you watch the Super Bowl on Sunday?
I did watch the Super Bowl that went into overtime.
This was watched by an average of 123.4 million viewers across CBS, Nickelodeon, Univision, and Paramount Plus. Were you one of the five people that streamed this on Paramount Plus?
So I had it going on two TVs, actually. In the living room, it was on the antenna directly from my CBS affiliate. And then in the bedroom, it was on Paramount Plus. Yes.
Oh, so you were streaming it on Paramount Plus. Yes, okay. Because yes, 120 million of this number was on CBS, 2.2 million on Univision. So, I mean, the Paramount Plus, I mean, they, I don't know what the number was for Paramount Plus, but it was minuscule in the grand scheme of things. But a great night for CBS. So great that they did a mass round of layoffs like the day after this number came out. So that's thanks everyone for this record setting number on our network, and you're fired. Wonderful network to work with. But we saw this demographic breakdown from Sports
Have
Media
seen,
Watch.
We have down ballot Delmos here.
If there's one thing that's going to live on, it's the color scheme of Showbuzz Daily that everyone is going to still
Conditional formatting. I need to give you a tutorial in Excel. This is basically standard Excel conditional formatting here.
Is it? Okay. Well, it's Showbuzz Daily formatting for me. But nonetheless, the biggest gain year over year, women 18 to 24, huge fans of Roger Goodell, obviously. Huge
Tony
factor.
Romo, I think.
Yeah. Yes, the 18 to 24 audience up the highest of anyone. Year over year. So they had a lot of factors working for them this year. This will probably be a tough number for any future Super Bowl to hit, with the combination of an overtime game, Taylor Swift, and the juggernaut that is the NFL.
Yes. Yeah, it was a great game. I watched it. I watched Usher and all of his friends. He had many of them just entertain people.
Were you excited when Ludacris showed up?
I had to have someone identify for me who Ludacris was. Yes, there was singing and song and dance.
Which wrestler had the best Super Bowl ad? There was Jade Cargill was in one. Steve Austin was in one.
Jade Cargill was in a Super Bowl ad?
Jade Cargill was in one with Aubrey Plaza. It was for Mountain Dew.
Okay.
Missed it, I guess. Okay.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
They made such a big deal about it on WWE programming, too.
Did they?
No.
I doubt that.
There was no mention of it at all.
That's an outside project. No, you don't promote
I guess those. So. But I know what you really care about in Canada. How did the Super Bowl do? 10 million viewers in Canada, folks, which is actually that's a pretty crazy number. This is on TSN, CTV, and RDS, and they measured 19...
Bigger than the Stanley Cup?
Yes, I would say this is certainly bigger than the Stanley Cup. It used to be the Grey Cup would outdraw the Super Bowl in Canada, but now it's flipped. The Super Bowl now does bigger than
the days of Doug Flutie are behind us. Let's be honest.
I mean, when Doug Flutie, I mean, that's our connection between the Argos and Bills. It's Doug Flutie. But 19 million unique viewers in Canada, which is half the population, just kind of nuts right. When you think about that.
Google tells me you have 38 million people there.
Okay. So they're stretching it. No, not really. Like that. There you go. So. 19 million people tuned in. I was not one of them. I was part of the other 50%. WWE ratings. Let's talk a bit about those. SmackDown on Friday, 2,578,000 viewers and a 0.75. So their best figure since August 25th, which was the tribute show for Bray Wyatt and Terry Funk. This coming off the press event with for WrestleMania, and probably going to be a number that is dwarfed by this Friday's number. I mean, they have loaded up SmackDown this week with Rock and Roman Reigns appearing. Logan Paul is wrestling. We'll see how much that matters for his first free match on television. But it would seem that this Friday they're gearing up for a big one.
Yes. I mean, this was a big rating. Last week's rating was big too. But I mean, what do you attribute this to? I think I attribute it to the hype coming off of the WrestleMania kickoff show and all that discussion and what had happened at the end of the episode the prior week with Cody sheepishly walking to the back and letting Dwayne have the spotlight. I mean, you can say what I want about the WrestleMania kickoff press conference, whatever it was, being a distraction in Las Vegas to.
Was it a press conference?
I think they called it a press event. Press event. Whatever. It took attention off of the Vince McMahon story to an extent, the WWE Vince McMahon story. But look, this SmackDown rating is really good, and there's clearly a lot of interest, at least in the story around Cody, and is he going to finish the story, and what's Rock up to, and who's Roman Reigns going to wrestle?
Rampage did 456,000 viewers and a 0.14 on Friday night, so this was their largest audience since April, largest demo number since October the 13th, and highest 35 to 49 audience since August the 11th. So my thought was, man, this must have had was this some kind of like NBA lead in of some sort? It seemed like they didn't have any big lead in before this. So I found this to be a fairly stunning number that this Rampage did this level of audience, but Rampage is there's some weeks it just, I mean, we're not talking the craziest fluctuations here of numbers, but it sometimes really is a crapshoot of what garners attention on a Friday night for Rampage and what does not. But this was a big show by Rampage standards.
They did have Mystico on the show. Am I right about that?
Mystico wrestled Matt Sydal on the show.
Yeah. There's nothing in the quarter hours. I mean, I'm not going to pull them up right now, but there's nothing in the quarter hours that was like, wow, there's this big spike. I mean, it's only a 1 hour show anyway, but Rampage is up in February in one episode here against the February of last year. But it is, you know, we are finally getting to the point where, like, you know, Rampage, which debuted in August 2021, has basically been sequentially down since that point. But is now starting to do a little bit better than it did last year, at least for 1 week. But it was an impressive rating on the Rampage scale.
Could Rampage become the number two show in the next 6 months?
No,
we're getting very close here between these two. There was not a whole lot of distance between Collision and Rampage this week.
Yeah, we have not been giving enough attention to the fact that, hey, we're out of college football season. Collision should be doing better, right?
Yeah, I mean, even up this week, Collision was at 498,000 and 0.15. Yeah, but we're looking at that today as a good Collision number. Yeah. I think that does kind of show you where things are. This was their best audience since October, highest demo of the year. Clearly, Esfinge has turned into an American sensation.
Yes.
Opening up Who? Collision. Star Jr., Esfinge. They opened up Collision. And then we had Tomohiro Ishii. Huge draw in the main event as well. And then Raw on Monday night, 1,747,000 viewers, 0.56, first on cable, and beating out a pair of college basketball games that were airing back-to-back against Raw on ESPN. So, I mean, a little down from the previous 2 weeks, but, I mean, still, you know, kind of in line with what they're going to be doing.
Yeah, and I can tell you in quarter hours that I will be posting for subscribers.
We haven't seen quarters yet.
Soon after we're done recording here. The Cody and Seth live promo had no ad breaks in it. It was the only quarter hour that had no ad breaks in it, but it did go over 2 million viewers. So, and what did the show average as a whole, by the way, 1.7 something?
$1,747,000
Yeah. So it was a big spike. Had the benefit of no ads in it, but big spike for that segment, and the YouTube views for the Raw show. I mean, reflect that as well in terms of that segment having a lot of interest in it.
So there you go. All of your ratings notes overall, a pretty strong week for both WWE and AEW. So we will see what Dynamite draws tonight as they are in, I don't know where they are tonight. They're in Cedar Park, Texas tonight.
HEB Arena or Center or whatever it's called.
That's right. Have you been looking at all at the WrestleMania events that week? Do you know what you're going to be doing in Philadelphia when you go down?
No, I need to get with John Cena and ask him what I should to give me a path for the weekend.
Well, you can go to postwrestling.com/mania for a whole schedule of all the events as curated by one John Cena. All of the events that are going down from Stardom to Josh Barnett's Bloodsport to a Jeff Hardy concert. All of these and more happening WrestleMania week in Philadelphia and New Jersey.
Are you in charge of this? Because your email is listed here.
I am listed here. I will disclose John Cena did all the heavy lifting here of culling this together. I mean, when you have that cage match connection, you reach out. I take all the errors. So if there's anything in there, which there is not, you can send me your updates. I've already got some updates from people. So they track us down, but that's all what is happening. It's not like the craziest WrestleMania week schedule. I feel we hit the peak a few years ago where it just seemed like it was 800 shows every single day.
And what would you say that was? The peak was 2019, pre-pandemic year?
I think in New York, certainly that first Dallas show in 2016, I remember there was just a insane schedule. But then, 2019, I would say, was maybe where they built up the highest. And then
as much of an appetite for the indie shows as there was, say, pre-AEW, before AEW took a lot of the talent up?
I think it's a bit less. This year will be very interesting. Like, Spring Break has already sold out. And I think Spring Break had kind of felt as though it had passed its real big peak, but there's a lot of demand for it. You can see they're getting very creative with their matchmaking. I wouldn't say we're at like 2018, 2019 levels, like pre-AEW as a whole. Like, there's going to be your winners and losers Mania week. Like, there's some shows that will just die. And there's others, like a Spring Break that's sold out. The Collective has several sellouts already. I think Stardom is almost sold out, if not completely sold out, and that's without even a match announcement as well. So it's like most Mania weeks, where I think the unique shows are going to do well, where you have the most curiosity, or seeing a product like Stardom that you're not going to have too many opportunities to see live.
Right. I am renting a car, I think. I think that is in the travel plan. So it sounds like am I renting a car? No, I think I'm going to rely on public transit. I could rent one, though.
The only thing I am guaranteed to see so far is the Mark Hitchcock Memorial Super Show that I'm going to on the Thursday night, and the rest is all up in the air. Me and Wei are just looking at this like, what are we going to hit?
On Friday or something, Thursday or Friday.
Do you think you will go to NXT and WrestleMania on the Saturday, or are you just going to do WrestleMania?
I don't know. I'm definitely going to go to WrestleMania. I have both nights, I guess, but yeah, I don't know if I'll.
It's a lot of wrestling in one day.
I'm not making any decisions at this point.
This is you've got to make your. This will be the big reveal, Brandon Thurston's WrestleMania week schedule that you can unveil here. We'll do a whole episode dedicated to it. Okay. But there you have it, everyone. We are going to wrap things up again. Thank you to Tim Marchman for joining us. Brandon is going to be back this Sunday. Patreon.com/WrestleNomics. For all of the latest news, what is going on in the industry. If you have questions, Brandon's got answers. Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern time, which I found Brandon's commentary over New Japan, New Beginning in Osaka, a perfect mix at times if you want to just have Brandon's voice over a 5-on-5 dog pound cage match. Perfect Sunday morning viewing and listening.
That's quite a choice. And later tonight, you can watch Rewind a Dynamite. I watch it every week. I don't know the name of it.
That's okay. Tonight,
how's that going to be?
10 Eastern, we'll talk about Dynamite from the HEB Center with Daniel Garcia against Adam Copeland. Buffalo versus Ontario, the latest battle. So tune into that. And then on Thursday, up at postwrestlingcafe.com, Wei and I will be doing a mailbag show going through all of your questions. We have 2 months worth of questions. So if you want to check in with that, we will be going through all of your questions on Thursday. So that is it for us. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. We're here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern time, and we'll speak with you next week.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.